thing is, in the matter of Lakewood Engineering and Manufacturing, Mr. Frank.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. I'm Joseph Frank, and I represent Jarden Consumer Solutions, JCS, and we're here today on a case concerning the sale of assets in bankruptcy. It's a case with issues that are central to both the policy and the law at the heart of the bankruptcy code, and it's a case that involves a situation where my client, JCS, paid more than...
Can you use real words and not made-up acronyms?
Where my client, Jarden, paid more than $6.2 million for assets of a Chapter 11 debtor, Lakewood, and then had to wait over 2 years for a bankruptcy court to make an equitable determination of what Jarden actually bought. The primary issue before the court is whether or not the bankruptcy court, when it finally made that decision, went beyond the authority provided under the bankruptcy code. And it doesn't matter how well-intentioned the bankruptcy court was. It doesn't matter whether the bankruptcy court wanted to honor the intent of the parties in contravention of the bankruptcy code. What matters is the authority of the bankruptcy court under the bankruptcy code. The bankruptcy court invoked a broad grant of equitable discretion in order to find that the rejection of a requirements contract that included a license of patents and a license of trademarks.
And I don't think you have to spend a lot of time in this circuit making the argument that courts can't intone equity and disregard statutes. I mean, if nothing else, our Kmart opinion, I had thought, put a stopper in that. The tough question on this appeal is whether Lubrizol is rightly decided. Right? The statute, the amendment of the statute in 1988 doesn't touch trademarks, but neither does it codify Lubrizol. So I should think that that's the big question we need to tackle. What's your view? Is Lubrizol rightly decided?
Well, Your Honor, I had the chance to argue the Kmart appeal, and I take to heart what the court said, so I'll move beyond the constrictions on the bankruptcy court. Was Lubrizol correctly decided? Lubrizol clearly was correctly decided. And the subsequent amendment of the bankruptcy code to add 365N further demonstrates that with respect to trademarks, there simply is no ability.
Whatever word comes after Lubrizol, clearly correctly decided, is not right. It may be right. I went looking to see whether anybody had said it was right. It's been widely criticized in the academic literature. I couldn't find anybody in the academic literature who thinks Lubrizol is right. And it does seem to be in tension with the provision in the bankruptcy code, particularly 365G, which says that rejection of a contract is treated as breach. Well, suppose A and B make a trademark contract outside of bankruptcy, and A has duties to B, and B is the licensee and has duties to A, and A breaches the contract. I think outside of bankruptcy, we would not say that A's breach terminates B's right to use the trademark. So that's what leads me to wonder whether Lubrizol is rightly decided. I mean, I ran into several bankruptcy scholars who said the only thing that would terminate B's right to use the trademark in this hypothetical is the trustee's use of his avoiding powers, if there was something wrong with the contract so it could be avoided. But otherwise, all that happens is that A's performance is turned into damages and B continues to have whatever rights B had under the contract. Right, that seems to be the scholarly consensus. Now, you may think that all the scholars are all wet and Lubrizol is right, but clearly it's not a word I would apply to that.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I still think Lubrizol is incorrect. And the reason I think Lubrizol is incorrect, well, there are a number of reasons. The first one I'll point to is that 365 cannot be read in a vacuum. 365 must be read in conjunction with Section 502 and in conjunction with Section 101. Section 502 gives a creditor who is subject to a rejected contract, and remember, this contract was rejected without opposition from Chicago American Manufacturing. It gives the party to a rejected contract under 502 the right to make a claim. That's at 502G of the bankruptcy code. And then the court would need to turn to Section 101.5. Section 101.5 and I'm talking about 101.5B, defines a claim as a right to damages or as a right to an equitable remedy if money damages are possible. Therefore, what the bankruptcy code does, and I think the amendment at 365N and the other carve-outs from rejection under 365 at 365H and I demonstrate, is put parties to executory contracts that are rejected in the position of other unsecured creditors. And it's not a one-step process through 365. And while I've certainly read the scholarly articles too, the scholarly articles I've read don't really address the 502G issue or the 101.5 issue. I think not only do we need to address this issue, we need to address the fact that rejection occurred, and then the parties went on their way. The bankruptcy court entered a rejection order and then later entered an opinion trying to, apparently, for equitable reasons, undo a part of the rejection order. And that's why we're here appealing today. So the rejection occurred and no rights were preserved. There was no statement that any part of the contract could not be rejected. The bankruptcy court's opinion was written in some reliance on a concurring opinion in the Exide Technologies bankruptcy from the Third Circuit. And that Third Circuit opinion.
But Judge Ambrose's opinion says two things as I read it. One is that there is such an equitable power, and that's hard to reconcile with Seventh Circuit law. And the other is that Lubrizol was wrong. It was wrong on the day it was decided. It's wrong today. It hasn't been codified by 365N. And that latter point is the one that bothers me and which you need to meet.
Well, I guess Lubrizol, to say that Lubrizol has not been codified by 365N, 365N was placed into the bankruptcy code in response to Lubrizol in order to address Lubrizol. And if the court is going to honor basic tenets of statutory construction, there is a negative inference, particularly with trademarks.
That's awfully hard. 365 says we're now having a rule with respect to intellectual property, and that turns out to be a defined term. And that rule covers copyrights and patents, and it doesn't cover trademarks. And there's even a statement in the legislative history that says, we are not addressing trademarks. Very hard to read that as somehow codifying a rule about trademarks. What we learn is they haven't addressed trademarks, so we got Lubrizol. And it's either right or wrong. Fourth Circuit thinks it's right. Judge Ambrose and a whole bunch of scholars think it's wrong. And we need to figure out whether it's right or wrong. I don't see how we can avoid that.
And getting back to the scholars don't tend to address trademarks, Your Honor. And trademarks, quite frankly, are unique. Trademarks, and they were addressed by this court in the Hartmarks XMH opinion. Trademarks are unique. They can't be transferred in gross. Therefore, the rights as they existed.
Trademarks were not transferred in bankruptcy, right? There was a trademark license agreement. The owner of the trademarks agreed to transfer them, or agreed to authorize Chicago American Manufacturing to use them for a time. The question is whether they can take that back when the contract is rejected. It's not the Hartmarks question.
Well, I understand the court's reading of the opinion, but I don't think that what the bankruptcy court did was say that they authorized them to use them for a time. I think what the bankruptcy court did was say, given my equitable powers, I'm going to find that the rights to use the trademarks vested. Remember, Your Honor, this was a requirements contract with a forecast and with a right to build fans to the forecast and with a right to actually sell the fans in the event that the fans in the forecast that were built, no delivery was taken within 30 days of the forecast. So on the petition date, the date of the rejection, the right to build fans was very limited. And nonetheless, post-rejection, Chicago American Manufacturing built another 100,000 fans and sold another 400,000.
That's a separate argument. You have two arguments. One is that Lakewood didn't have the right under the contract to bill these fans and put the Lakewood trademark on them. I understand that as a separate argument. But that's quite different from the argument that even if Lakewood had that right by contract, the rejection of the contract terminated it.
Fair point, and I think I want to distinguish because we raised two issues, one with respect to patents and one with respect to trademarks. And with respect to patents, clearly it is covered by Section 365N, and 365N locks in the patent rights as of the petition date. So with respect to patents, that clearly falls under 365N, and only the rights as they existed on the petition date are available to Chicago American Manufacturing. With respect to trademarks, the question is, was it possible for Lakewood to transfer the trademarks to Chicago American Manufacturing? And then post-rejection, is it possible for Chicago American Manufacturing under that law to continue to issue products using the trademarks without the supervision of the owner? It's a truly unique situation, and it's not a situation addressed in the scholarly works that I've seen. Mostly the scholarly works talk about transfers of hard assets and whether or not you can avoid and recover hard assets. Here, there was no hard asset transferred. There was something truly unique, a trademark that served a function of consumer protection that needed to be monitored by the debtor or the trustee, and that when once the debtor or trustee rejected it, could no longer be monitored by the debtor or trustee.
Why not?
Because they, by rejecting, absolved themselves of that obligation. They turned that obligation into a claim for money damages.
By rejecting, they got rid of any prospect that the court can award specific performance against them. They didn't get rid of their obligations. They just turned them into money.
That's correct, Your Honor. And by building fans, Chicago American Manufacturing avoided its obligation to make a claim for money damages under Section 502 and Section 101 and turned its claim into a self-help remedy of specific performance. That's what they argue in their own brief.
You lose me. What performance by the trustee was Chicago American demanding or getting? It didn't say there was any performance it wanted. It just said it wanted to keep its right to make and sell the fans.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it didn't say that. There was a rejection hearing, and Cam was silent, so it didn't say that. Had it said that, perhaps the trustee would have said, wait a minute, an agreement to transfer the right to build 1.2 million fans by a company 2 months before it winds up in bankruptcy is an avoidable transfer and would have sought to avoid it.
Well, that would have been interesting. If the trustee had tried to use his avoiding powers, we would have a different case, but the trustee didn't do that. This wasn't characterized as a preferential transfer or anything that might be avoidable.
It certainly wasn't. It was a rejection action, and there was no statement at the rejection hearing that the contract could not be rejected.
But you don't want to say we're just going to collapse the concepts of rejection and avoidance. They're completely different ideas in bankruptcy law. And to say one is the same as the other, so let's not worry about details, is, you know, doesn't sit well with me, at least.
Well, Your Honor, that's certainly not what I want to say. What I want to say, it's clear that when a transfer is avoided, a claim arises under Section 502H. When a contract is rejected and a claim arises, it arises under 502G. But in both cases, it is a claim for money damages when a contract is rejected. Your Honor, I want to address the issue of specific performance as well, because that is an argument that's in the brief. And I think it's pretty clear that there was no right to specific performance, and yet the brief extensively raises the issue of specific performance and a right thereto. I think that argument fails for a number of reasons. I think it's clear to me that the court understands that, and the issue is really Lubrizol. So other than the patent issue, which I think I've fully addressed, I'd just like to reserve my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Barrett.
Good morning. May it please the court, we advise the clerk that I may allocate 3 minutes to Mr. Richard Huffman, who was lead trial counsel. In the event there are questions regarding the record, that I referred to him. Otherwise,
if we have any questions regarding the record, we will ask them of the person who is standing. It is your obligation to know the record.
That's fine, Your Honor. We'll proceed that way. First of all, I'd like to correct one statement regarding the record. At the hearing on rejection of the contract, we did, in fact, appear, and we stated, as reflected in Judge Hollis's opinion, a concern as to what the meaning of rejection was. The decision to reject the contract was the trustee's business judgment. It may well have been a wise business decision for this trustee to reject the contract, but it doesn't speak to what its effect of rejection. This litigation started shortly after that hearing and some weeks before Jarden ever got involved in its purchase of the assets of Chicago Area Manufacturing. I agree with the court. I think dead on is the question of what to do with the Lubrizol opinion and what is its meaning here. I believe Lubrizol was wrongly decided, and the court made its error in this way. It understood the arguments that are made here. It considered them, but it thought...
We looked and couldn't find any appellate decisions on the Lubrizol question other than Lubrizol and Judge Ambrose's opinion. Did you find any others?
Your Honor, we have not found any others. We have found...
It's weird. Lubrizol is 27 years old.
It is somewhat unusual, and there really is a dearth of district court opinions as well on the issue. I believe the error in Lubrizol was the court found a federal bankruptcy policy that favored maximizing the value of assets for creditors over recognizing or preserving the existing pre-petition property rights of others. At issue in that case was a sale of assets and whether or not certain technology rights owned by the debtor would or would not be encumbered by a pre-petition transfer of a license, grant of a license. And the court found that the assets will sell for a higher price for the benefit of creditors if the effect of rejection is to terminate the licensee's right to use the technology. A similar argument was made in this court recently in the case of Peterson versus McLadry. It did not concern a license. It concerned a cause of action under state law that became property of the bankruptcy estate. And in that case, Chapter 7 trustee urged that the state law defense of in pari delicto did not attach to the claim as that claim entered the bankruptcy court. And for arguments very similar to those observed by the Fourth Circuit in Lubrizol, that there was a broader bankruptcy policy of providing some compensation or protection for victims of a Ponzi scheme, which was at issue in the Peterson case. But I think this court correctly, following Supreme Court authority in Butner versus United States, Raleigh versus Illinois Department of Revenue, found that the property rights of the parties are not affected by a bankruptcy filing unless where Congress has specifically said they should be. An example would be the fraudulent transfer avoidance powers of Chapter 5 of the Bankruptcy Code. In this case, there's been no suggestion that the grant license rights to Chicago Manufacturing was a fraudulent transfer, was a preference, was anything other than a bona fide transfer of rights to use technology and trademarks for a specific period of time for a specific quantity of goods. I want to address also the argument, I think though it is extensively covered in the briefs and the opinion, while this contract had aspects of being a requirements contract, at least on the side of Lakewood, from the side of Chicago Area Manufacturing, it was a fixed quantity obligation. And it was a difference between the two, the spread between the two, that gives rise to the right to sell those fans that were manufactured to the forecast, but which, as it turns out, Lakewood never took. This is not a contract for sale of coal. These were fans that required some advanced manufacturer, had a season that was, as the record, a very seasonal product. Lakewood, which needed the product, wasn't quite sure when its customers would want the product, when they would order the product. And therefore, you had this mechanism whereby the product would be made in advance to an expectation or a forecast, and then a protection for the manufacturer should Lakewood never, in fact, require the product. Finally, I'd like to cover the specific performance. Both the authorities here and in court and the parties, we use the term specific performance. This is not truly a classic specific performance case. This is not a contract where there's a contract to buy a house that hasn't closed yet, and then the seller breaches and refuses to honor the contract. In this contract, the property item, the license to use, the trademark, and the patent had already occurred, had been consummated prior to the bankruptcy filing. This is more akin to the situation where the buyer is already in the house, And as one of the authorities cited, Professor Barrett, that this is the situation of a licensee in possession, not a licensee with an expectation, some future rights to use trademark or patents, but the current right, the right that had matured and was vested at the time of the bankruptcy filing. Your Honors, that is our argument. If there are no further questions, we ask that the Court affirm the decision of the Bankruptcy Court.
Very much. Anything further, Mr. Frank?
Yes, Your Honor, a few things. I understand the intrigue of Lubrizol and the fact that circuit courts have not addressed Lubrizol since the bankruptcy code was amended in 1988, but I dare say this is not the case to take on Lubrizol, and there's a reason for that. It's not just wishful thinking on my part. Your Honor, I want to read a quotation from the bankruptcy court's opinion. Quote, in the absence of controlling authority on this point from the Seventh Circuit, this court is persuaded by Judge Ambrose's reasoning. It will not follow in lockstep fashion those few trial courts to have decided that the non-binding Lubrizol holding is the only possible outcome. Instead of bemoaning the chilling effect Lubrizol might impose on the licensees, the court will step into the breach, as it were, and begin the, quote, development of equitable treatment, unquote, Congress anticipated would occur. The problem underlying using this case as the opportunity to address the Lubrizol question is that the court relied on a broad finding of equity under Section 365 and legislative history as the basis for making its factual findings. And therefore, there's no basis to find that the rights had vested as of the petition date, the effective date of rejection, and therefore that they had the ability to build all these contracts. Counsel stated that this was not a requirements contract, but on the contrary, the bankruptcy court made a specific finding that this was a requirements contract. And we've cited authority for how requirements contracts are treated in Illinois. And there's no basis to say that this requirements contract was different and somehow vested the right to build all forecast requirements on the day the contract was signed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Our next case.